Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. Really excited to welcome to our program today Eve Spangler. She's an individual that's not only been able to spend her life as a civil rights activist, but also she's written a thought-provoking book that I think all of us can appreciate. It's called Understanding Israel-Palestine: Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Now, no matter where you all live in the world, I know you all have heard of Israel, you've heard of Palestine, but I think after this conversation, Eve will be able to help you to look at things a little bit differently and hopefully to be able to have questions that you'll want to find the answers for yourself. We'll talk to Eve not only about the journey of writing this book, but what she hopes you're able to take away from it. Eve, hello to you and welcome to the show.
Hello, Cyrus. I'm so excited and pleased and honored to be on the show. And let's take it away.
Right. Well, you know, there is so much for us to cover. And as I was saying to you before we went live here, we'll make sure to let our listeners know how they can get the book for themselves. The first thing I want to do, though, is just talk to you about the journey to this point, because this is something you've been focusing a lot of attention on. I noticed when I was prepping for this segment, even before the book came out, and that is being able to help people to get a better view of Israel and Palestine and what's been happening with them. You know, what is it that led you initially on this journey, Eve?
Well, you know, as most major life decisions are, it's partly fate and partly coincidence. I'm Jewish. I come from a family that was devastated by the Holocaust and whose survivors didn't get here until the early 1940s. So out of that thing, to have that in the middle of your family history, many people go toward Zionism. They go toward, oh my gosh, Jews need a safe house. They need a room of their own. Doesn't matter who else is in that room, they got to get out, we have to have safety. My family had a little bit of a different pathway. They said, you're never going to be sentimental about governments, about states. The bedrock is human rights and holding states accountable for not harming people, but for protecting them. And so that's the deep background, as I was always interested in human rights. And then, you know, the coincidence is that I had done work. I was active in the civil rights movement in high school with Reverend Milton Galamison in New York in the city school boycotts. You know, and I went on to be active in the anti-war movement, the women's movement, and so forth. But on a particular night in 2003, I was between projects. I'm associate professor of sociology at BC. And a colleague came and said, you've got to come to this talk. I'm afraid we're not going to have an audience. I'd wanted to go home and read my book club novel and drink a glass of wine, but I went to the event, and it was a Palestinian and an Israeli talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict. The Palestinian spoke first, and he explained about the massive ethnic cleansing, the expulsion of Palestinians from their own homes in Palestine, associated with the creation of the Jewish state in 1947 to 1949. And not by coincidence, I had known a lot more as, you know, a literate person, a reader of the New York Times. I'd known a lot more about Israel and virtually nothing about Palestine. So I thought, well, you know, wow, that's terrible, but let's see what the Israeli has to say. And then the Israeli got up and pointed to the Palestinian and said, he's understating it. The reality is worse. Well, I was hooked. And in a university, you know, I can read what I want, think about what I want. So I started reading, I started going there. I teach a seminar on the subject, and I take students from that seminar over winter break every year, 7 years now, over 100 students. And we talk to Palestinian and Israeli human rights activists. And so finally I thought, you know, I want to reach more people than I can reach in my class. And that's how I came to write the book.
Yeah. You knew, though, going into this, that this was going to spark some very passionate discussions and of course, opinions, though, right? I mean, going into a topic like this.
Yeah, I sure did. And that's why, you know, in this book, I try to say to people, look, it's not just a question of knowing a whole lot of facts, because nobody wants to be, you know, in a dueling factoid conversation about anything.
Right.
It's about having a framework that shapes what you're looking for. And the framework I chose is human rights. And I choose that for a lot of reasons. First of all, because it starts by the premise that every human being has dignity and worth and should be treated with respect. Where else am I going to start? But also equally important, I think human rights faces forward. It faces the future. And it says, okay, everybody who's here now gets to stay. No one gets pushed into the sea, but everyone has to be treated right. That's the bedrock. And I think
right.
that's a more useful framing than, you know, this happened in 1878 and this happened in 1929, because that's sort of backward-facing. The challenge in human rights, and you're right about the controversy, is that it also implicitly demands action. You can't hide forever behind he said, she said, you know, why don't they just use their words, let's split the difference. The truth isn't halfway between Martin Luther King and the Ku Klux Klan. The truth isn't halfway between a sexual trafficker and a child. You know, once you see the human rights issues, you have to stand up and take notice. Mm-hmm. And I think for Americans, you know, the human rights issue we've been coached to see is Israeli safety. You know, we have this week Senator Schumer saying saying he won't support President Obama on the Iran treaty, that, you know, Shomer is the Hebrew word for guardian, and he is the guardian of Israel's interests in the Senate. You know, that for me is a terribly problematic statement. But the human rights issue most people are aware of is Israeli safety. Who talks about Palestinian safety? A year ago, there was not only Ferguson, but there was Operation Protective Edge. 2,200 Palestinians were killed. Most of them now remain homeless. 70% of those killed were civilians by Amnesty International calculations. 500 of them were children. Palestinians killed 72 Israelis, four of whom were civilians. And yet the prevailing framework is we should be talking about Israeli safety. I don't think we can do that without talking about Palestinian safety as well.
Right. Right. And that is where I think the reader will come in, even be able to realize that there are, you know, I think the truth in the middle of, as you said, you know, what is being said. I want to first reset for those who are just tuning in. You're listening to Conversations
Sure.
Live. Eve Spangler is our guest today. She's the author of the book Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. I want to go back to what you referenced, because I mentioned to you before mm-hmm. we went live here, I had never heard of or remember reading from the 1940s, what happened when it came to Israel and Palestine, especially to the Palestinians that were living in Israel. Now, I just want to read actually from the book. For those
sure.
who have the print edition, it's on page 119. It's in the chapter Establishing the State, Preparing Occupation. And this is what you wrote about the state of the Palestinians that were living in Israel. Then I want to make a modern comparison to the states here. You wrote this: not only were Palestinians' claims to their own property assaulted, they themselves were deemed by later administrations to be security risks to the state. They were therefore required to live under military law. This state of affairs, Israeli Jews governed by civil law and Palestinian citizens of Israel under military rule, persisted until 1966. The declared state of emergency persists to this day. These arrangements explain why Palestinians often say that for Jews, Israel is a democracy, and for Palestinians, Israel is a Jewish state. Now, what was so interesting to me about that when I initially read it, Eve, was that there are people who could very easily, you know, take out, you know, Israel and Palestinian
mm-hmm.
and put in black and white in the United States when they talk about things that happen. And I bring that up because the interesting comparison that you made that honestly I had never thought about was what happened with slavery in the States. I mean, how did
mm-hmm.
you get to looking at it that way and realizing that in a sense that was an appropriate comparison?
Well, you know, I was thinking about, in my mind, I was talking to people in church groups and on campuses, mostly in America, because in addition, human rights doctrine requires that we're not the kings of the world. We don't tell other people what to do, but we do have the right to tell our own government what to do. And the way we do that usually is through conversations that start in churches and on campuses. So I was trying to think, how do I talk to Americans, and what would Americans know that's like this? And I think the parallel with the black experience is really profound. In many ways, I mean, we are this week, you know, in the anniversary of Operation Protective Edge in Palestine, where so many Palestinians were killed, and almost 2 million Palestinians and in Gaza are homeless, remain homeless. But we're also in the 50th anniversary of Watts and the first anniversary of Ferguson. And so those parallels are just right there if you're attuned at all to civil rights. Mm-hmm. And so the analogy I make is between Zionism, the desire, it's a very specific project within the Jewish desire for safety and community. It's a project that wants to build an ethno-religiously exclusive state in a very multicultural piece of geography, Israel-Palestine. The parallel between Zionism and the Back to Africa movement, both representing a very small subset of people who come from communities where they're really being abused, they're really being mistreated. And unlike those who choose either to try to assimilate or to reform the system where they are, there's a small number of people who choose to leave. And that was Zionists among Jews in Europe and the Back to Africa movement among African Americans here. And, you know, you got to start by acknowledging that Israel is way more economically successful than Liberia. But apart from that, the parallels are striking. You know, the majority of people who were supposed to benefit from Zionism or Back to Africa wanted no part of it. More than half of Jews today choose not to live in Israel. They wanted no part of it, but the movement persisted because it had very smart leaders who could lobby governments, raise funds, recruit settlers. They had allies, both Back to Africa and Zionism. Some of those allies were genuine human rights activists who said people should be free to go where they want to go. But many of them were really awful racists who were happy to get blacks out of America or Jews out of Christendom. Both movements took, you know, named a place that was supposedly their point of origin pretty opportunistically because great powers gave them that particular bunch of land to think about. And both of them rode roughshod over the rights of the indigenous people when they got there. So those parallels are just incredibly powerful.
You mentioned the Zionists. I'm sorry.
To me. Okay. They were powerful.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and I was just going to say, you mentioned the Zionists. It reminded me of another passage that I had read that was really interesting to me, and I think it goes to what we see now being played out, especially in the media. In the chapter Four Frames, you wrote this on page 180 of the book. Similarly, the issue raised by the Israeli self-defense framework is less about facts. Palestine does face occupation and dismemberment, and Israel, in turn, does face real problems and costs associated with Palestinian resistance to the occupation. But then you wrote this: the debate now is how to understand Israel's difficulties, whether as self-inflicted, chosen suffering in service to Zionist ambitions, or as a result of senseless and anti-Semiticism on the part of Palestinians and their supporters around the world. And then, of course, you go into talking about, you know, what some people will normally bring about when it comes to siding with Israel, and that is, you know, the references to the Holocaust and the annihilation, of course, of Israel. Do you think, you know, and this chapter also talks a great deal about power. Is that also a part of this conversation, Eve, do you think, that has become one-sided, that people focus, you know, maybe because it is the way it is framed in the media, that they focus more on Palestine's, you know, quest for power instead of looking at Israel and Palestine both wanting to have power?
Absolutely. I think the imbalance, you know, everybody knows about and thinks about Israeli safety. But as I say, you know, if you had horrible gang warfare in some American city and one gang killed 72 people and the other gang killed 2,200, whose safety would we be worrying about? Who would we see as the aggressor? And yet in Israel-Palestine, that is flipped. So let me say very quickly, you know, even the people who decided to be Zionists and who wanted to leave Europe and had established colonies in Argentina, when the British said, now you can have a piece of Palestine, so they said, okay, we'll go there. The Holy Land could never have been an empty land. And their leaders knew from the very beginning that it was densely populated. And so they made a choice. And the choice was they could have chosen a Jewish homeland, adding themselves in to a multi-ethnic community, as many Jews were doing in Cairo and Baghdad and Beirut, or they could have opted for an exclusively Jewish state. If they made that option, they had a problem because half the people, now half the people, then even a greater percentage of the people under their control were not of the desired religion and ethnicity. So what do you do with them if you want to be a ethno-religiously exclusive community? You know, this is a 19th century view of nationalism that there's only going to be one kind of person here and it's all very homogeneous. We call that balkanization, and it usually doesn't work out well. So even at the time, there were cultural Zionists who said that's the wrong way to go. Look for a homeland. Add yourself in. Don't look to dominate. Don't look to expel. Don't look to ethnically cleanse. Really smart people. Martin Buber says excessive nationalism will lead only to a tiny state of Jews, completely militarized and unsustainable. Hannah Arendt says a Jewish homeland should never be sacrificed to the pseudo-sovereignty of a Jewish state built on Arab suppression. So there were some pretty smart people who called this a long time ago and said, you know, Israel and Palestine together are a little bit bigger than New Jersey, and it's situated on the land bridge between Asia and Europe, Asia and Africa. It's the most multicultural place in the world. And you have a group of people coming in with a political project to take it over for themselves, to get everybody else out, to have an ethno-religiously exclusive state. That's a very problematic project. The desire for safety, that's not problematic. But this project is the way to get to that safety is, I think, very self-defeating.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting thing. And again, this conversation, and I really hope our listeners think about it this way, Eve, is to be able to show that, you know, all of us, it bears, you know, to repeat this, even though I said it earlier, you know, should be interested in the history and to know more than what is heard on the news and to be able to hear more than just a sound bite. I think, you know, we talk about on this program a lot, Eve, about the power of words. And mm-hmm. a lot of times you will watch things that are said, and on my news program that I also do for the radio in my home state of Mississippi, there's been lots of conversations about some of the statements that are made by Benjamin Netanyahu about, of course, the safety and security of Israel. Do you think that's another thing that we need to be very careful of is how we use words? One of the things that you reference in the book is even Secretary of State John Kerry using the word apartheid. Infusing it into that conversation and people knowing where that leads people to thinking when you hear that word. I mean, is that also part of your hope that we're very careful about using words like that unless we really know the history of what we're talking about?
Yes, I am definitely for being careful about how we use words. And we can come back to apartheid, I think, is not a bad description, actually, of because it means apartness, the separate legal systems which govern the 12 million people who live now in Israel-Palestine, almost exactly equally divided between Israeli Jews and Palestinians. Israeli Jews live under civil law. Palestinian citizens of Israel live under civil law where they have only a relatively small subset of the rights that Israeli Jewish citizens have. Palestinians in East Jerusalem and the West Bank and Gaza live under Israeli military law that has a 99% conviction rate. So they are stateless and living under a regimen without rights. But, you know, I think it's also important to apply the same standards to people on both sides when they speak and, talk about a very harmful use of words. There's an Israeli politician who's a rabbi, Eli Ben-Dehan, and he has been appointed as the second in command of the entire West Bank, of the military apparatus in the West Bank, under which 2.5 million Palestinian citizens live with no rights and no citizenship. And he has said on more than one occasion that Palestinians are subhuman beasts. And he's in charge of the military that governs their lives. Now, people have responded, of course, to the racism in that statement, and it's terrible, and of course they should have. But there's something even more profound going on. all of the monotheisms, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, posit a single creator God. So we are all brothers and sisters. We are all the descendants of that single creative force, which means we have some moral obligations to each other. Now, how do you honor those moral obligations if you're oppressing people and expelling them? Well, one way is to say they aren't really people. They're subhuman beasts. And, you know, I think there's a not indirect path between a rabbi who is running the West Bank saying these are subhuman beasts, an Israeli army that defends settlers who burn Palestinian olive orchards during the harvest, and a settler who last week snuck up on a Palestinian home in Douma, opened the window, and threw a firebomb into a room where an 18-month-old baby lay sleeping. That baby is now dead. That baby's father is now dead from the fire. The people who were rounded up and arrested by the Israeli army for questioning were released yesterday morning. There are no arrests now for this crime. Of course, that crime is the responsibility of the individuals who opened that window and threw that firebomb. But those individuals are living in a community where, in word and deed, they understand themselves to be supported by their government in so doing. And that is tragic.
Yeah. Again, it really shows us the human aspect of this conversation. And again, that's what should unite people. What was your hope? I know this was something that was fascinating to you, going back to the conversation that you heard between the Israeli and the Palestinian that we kind of talked about at the beginning of this program, Eve. But what was your hope for writing the book and sharing it with the world? What were you hoping that readers around the world would take away from it?
Well, I was hoping that we've seen many other situations that people said there's no hope, it can only end in a bloodbath. Apartheid is the big one, obviously, but Northern Ireland is also an example that, in fact, did shift and did get resolved, not perfectly and not for all time, but things are better. And so my hope was to say to people, this conflict, which looks hopeless too, actually, there are grounds for hope. And particularly, I have to admit, for an American audience, there are grounds for hope because we have tools like boycotts. You know, my earliest political action was in high school in Brooklyn, New York. Milton Galamison, a black minister in Crown Heights, called for a boycott of public schools until the state did something more to desegregate them. So that was my first political action. And now we still have that tool. So there's a boycott, sanctions, divestment movement that's very powerful. There's political lobbying that we can do. So Americans have tools. Americans have the freedom to educate themselves and to speak up and to take action. And we have partners in Israel and Palestine. All Israelis are not like the Netanyahu government. All Palestinians are not like Hamas or other violent factions. Palestinians have the highest per capita PhDs of any Arab population. They're ferociously interested in education. They had a favorable balance of trade with Europe for the whole century before Zionism began. We have two communities over there whose average ordinary people are educated, entrepreneurial, and wanting to get on with their lives. So we have tools and we have partners. And so I wrote the book in the hope that this would seem to people, when they've read the book, less like a hopeless conflict and a little bit more like something they may want to learn something about and take actions in their churches, on their campuses, wherever it is that they're active.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's the thing. And I think hopefully that our listeners also appreciate the importance, you know, of for one thing, being able to get a full picture of things that we're hearing about, that we know about. Because just like in our everyday lives, you know, we know that, you know, there's always more than one side to a story, mm-hmm. that we would always be able to look for the truth. And I think allowing that truth to be able to guide us, and no matter what we might be discussing, hearing about, and then, of course, especially commenting on, and I think that's the big thing, Eve. A lot of times we talk about things without really knowing the full picture, just based on hearing one side of things. And I love the fact that with this book, you're able to give us the history. And then, of course, from there, you know, we're able to better understand what's happening, as well as, of course, what needs to happen to be able to really get to a place where everyone will be able to not only be able to work together, but also to realize the importance of each other, to value one another as well. Again, everyone, Eve Spangler has been our guest. Great conversation with you today, Eve. The book is Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. We mentioned earlier, Eve, that the book is available through Amazon.com. How else can our listeners stay connected with you?
I'm very easy to reach. I'm a Spangler at bc.edu. That's for bostoncollege.edu. I welcome comments and conversations. I'm on Facebook, and so and clearly I could talk about this nonstop 24/7, so I welcome conversations and contact.
All right, so make sure you all are staying connected with Eve. Eve, again, congratulations on the book, and looking forward to staying connected with you.
Thank you so much, Cyrus. This has really been a great conversation. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hey, you're more than welcome. And we thank you, our listeners, for joining us for another great segment of Conversations Live. I want to thank our good friend, Gail Leander Wright, of course, for setting up this conversation with us today. And thank you, our listeners, for joining us for another great show. If you all came in late and you missed part of the conversation, don't worry. Thanks to our online friends, you all can catch the replay right after we go off the air. The link is already available on our social media sites at facebook.com/CyrusWeb or head over to twitter.com/CyrusWeb. You can click on the link and listen to the show completely for free and share it with your friends from there. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Make sure you take out time to enjoy some good music as well as a great book. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live. You all make it a great one.